Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Everybody, you're tuned into the Three Questions. I'm Andy Richter, and I'm talking to Lori Kilmartin today, who is a hilarious stand-up, was my office neighbor for like 9 years, something like that, wasn't it?
I think so. I was down at the other end for a while, for a little bit, yeah.
Right. I had you moved. I just couldn't stand the noise. No, but I'm very happy to have Lori here. She's a hilarious, hilarious person and a very nice person. I mean, as far as I know. I mean, do you ever really know your coworkers?
We don't, and we shared a wall, and I still feel like I don't know you, and I'm okay with that. Like, I don't need to know everyone's secrets or what they're really like.
Oh, well, you're going to get them all today. Well, first of all, I need to congratulate you, Emmy nominee. We found that out this morning.
Yeah, but I think it's just the show.
Yeah, like, but it's you made the show.
Okay, we get to go then. No, absolutely. We don't get to go, but we get to watch.
Writers don't get to go?
I thought it would. The writing didn't get nominated, but the show did. So I think that's Conan and Jeff Ross and maybe Matt O'Brien. I don't know. I'm not buying a dress.
There's part of me that's like, hearing that, I'm kind of like, oh, don't I get to go? And then there's part of me that's like, shut up. Shut up. Don't go.
Yeah. Is it just the producers that go?
I'm not sure. That's also vague.
What if Conan wasn't allowed to go and it was just Jeff Ross?
What a party. I don't know. I mean, it's very exciting and it's very nice that we've been posthumously nominated.
Yes. Right.
and it's all really great, but it is and I always sound like such a dick, and I've talked about this before, but going to the Emmys. Have you been to the Emmys?
Just once. Back in, I think when we got nominated right after the TBS show debuted, maybe 2011 or 10.
Yeah, I think that was probably the last time I went to. And I've been a few times because we used to, early on in the Conan days, we'd get nominated for writing almost every year.
Yeah.
And we'd all... It was fun. It was a fun weekend because we would all fly out on a red eye to LA and all our writers, I would get, because I'm on camera talent, I would be entitled to a first class seat.
Sure. But,
and I would split it into two business class seats for my then wife. And we would go together. And it was so funny because, like, I just remember one year, all our writers walking back into coach past Chris Rock writers.
Oh, no.
Like, all the Chris Rock writers were in first class. Like, HBO had been like,
oh, my God.
Yeah, we're going to get your first class tickets. And they were all walking past, like, and some of them had been Conan writers.
Oh, hilarious.
Like, some of them had been former Conan writers.
Sure.
Because it's that, like, it's, you know, it falls into that gray area of whether they should buy a ticket or not. You know, it's like, it's sort of extracurricular. Like it's not necessarily a job thing that you go to the Emmys and be there as an employee of the show.
Oh, sure. But you got to go. You got to go when you're nominated.
Yeah, no, you got to go, but they don't have to fly your first class is my
point. Oh, sure. But if it's Modern Family at some point, maybe you don't got to go.
Right.
You just pick yours up the next day at the office. But, and it seems like, just not with our category, but with a lot of categories, that the Emmys are so far behind what's happening on television.
Yes.
You know, and even like stand-up comedy specials, one of them was competing with a tribute to John Lewis. It's like, what? Yeah. How is that happening? So
we lost 1 year, and I thought we had a really good chance that year. We lost to an Eddie Izzard stand-up hour. Like, we were making TV at that point like 47 weeks out of the year. And I was like, oh, come on. We work so. In fact, I think Chris Rock won writing once for his show and said, you guys should give one of these to Conan. Those guys do all the work, you know.
I remember that. Yeah, it's always depressing. It's just, it's fun to be picked, and then it's depressing when you're not, but, oh well.
It's also weird because every time somebody wins that you don't like, you're like, oh, these things are bullshit. They don't mean anything. And then when somebody that you do like wins, you go, oh, justice. Yes, this, now it's right. You know, like it's, they're only right when I agree with them. So.
Correct.
Well, enough about that, Emmys. Uh-huh. How are you dealing with unemployment? Do you consider yourself unemployed?
Yeah, I do. I have some stand-up work, you know, so I've been doing some road work in July. And that's been pretty cool. It's also, I love it. And I just got back from Phoenix. I was in at a club called Stir Crazy in Glendale, Arizona last weekend. And the whole week preceding, I was worried, like, can I do 50 minutes again? Like, I've only done, you know, even live shows in LA, like 10 or 15 minutes at the most. And on Zoom, you know, Zoom doesn't count because you could have your notes all over your computer. So, I was like, it's still there. And the crowds, you know, are still up and down. Yes.
Yeah. It's still a mixed bag.
You know, exactly.
It's ultimately unsatisfying.
There are still audience-wide Amber Alerts going off on their phones during the show. Yes. Thank you.
Well, it's Arizona.
You know. It was a dust storm advisory. I was like, oh, wow. You guys.
Dust storm. Mm-hmm. It would have been great if the dust storm had actually interrupted. Like if somehow
that's a hard one to combat. You can't have it removed. You just got to perform
you
through
can't
it.
Power through it. Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. I mean, how did you feel as the show kind of wound down, the Conan show?
How
long had you worked there? Did you start
I was with
Tonight
the
show?
CBS. No, I wasn't. I started at CBS. So, I understood why it happened, you know, you know, everyone sort of going to streaming and stuff. I think I was still in shock from visiting the studio to get my stuff or visiting our offices. And then I just walked into the studio to check it out. And it was completely dismantled.
Yeah.
Just wood everywhere. Like a bomb had blown off. And I think that really depressed me a lot. You know, like I wasn't able to take one last turn, you know, just to kind of have a few memories. I'm like, I don't even know where the mono mark is. I don't know where any of my landmarks are. It's just completely destroyed. So, you know, and I wish we could have had more of a, you know, everyone there. And just because of COVID and stuff, it was all still too careful and stuff. Oh, well.
Well, I actually kind of feel like COVID changed the context of the end of the show in a way that I think made it so out of the ordinary, or the ordinary of the previous 10 years, that it was kind of less sad. You know, it all was kind of like extra special weird circumstances.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if we'd just been in the studio and the show just kind of kept going along and then just stopped. And then, you know, that to me seems like way more, I don't know. You know, there's something about a worldwide pandemic that really takes your mind off the fact that your talk show got canceled, or,
I know.
Stopped working or, you know.
Yes. No, you're right. It was just sort of like how people sort of, you know, just kind of peeled off, and it's like, you know, everyone's sending big emails to everybody, but it's like, oh, I probably might not ever see you again. And I wish I'd known that the last time I saw you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I guess we all feel that way about a lot of things, but I think, I see what you're saying. I mean, it, you know, what is it in the big picture of things? It's a talk show, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But just for us personally, it does become a family, especially this one. And I hope we can all see each other again before everyone just is flung out to all different parts of the world and maybe have a big wrap party or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was that little one sort of after, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there was kind of a little one on premises, but it was, what are you telling people? Like when people ask you, like, what's going on with the next Conan show? What do you tell them?
I say, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows, right?
No, I know. I have so many people asking me as if it's like some sort of, there's some secret plot or something, you know, or like there's some, or there's even like a big struggle. It's like, no one, they can't agree on what it's supposed to be. And so no one knows. And just,
yeah. And I think everyone's
so unsatisfying, you know?
Everyone's just sort of decompressing this month anyway, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, somebody brought me up on stage. Another comic was like, let's hear it for her. She just got fired. It's like, you know, no one knows me and you don't have to, could you not be interested in my employment situation? Right. Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah. You got fired. And then they took away the show too, just as cover.
They fired me first. And
You're fired. Oh, and by the way, I kept walking around saying like, oh shit, I forgot to give my 2 weeks notice for the last 2 weeks. I was going to say, I'm out of here. Well, let's get to you and you especially. Oh, come on. Do you not like talking about yourself?
I don't know. There's not much here. I'm a pretty shallow lady. So, it'll be quick. There's not many nuggets of gold in this little stream.
Oh, come on. That's not true. I mean, well, you can't be as funny and as good as you are doing what you do and be shallow.
All right. You know what? It's not my call. I feel
right,
like
right,
it,
right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, definitely the audience will decide and you will find out. I will make sure you know. So you're from Northern California, correct?
I'm from Walnut Creek, California.
Is that a fancy town?
It wasn't when I was born there. It started getting fancier once they started putting concrete over the creeks and cutting down the walnut trees. Then Walnut Creek really came into its own.
Wow.
So when I go back now, it feels like Pasadena at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
It's like everyone buys their stuff at Pottery Barn there. It just feels like one of those cities, but it wasn't
like
when I was
a yuppie
a kid.
Enclave of outside a metropolitan area. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But it was a lot of fun when I was growing up there. There was a railroad track, so we had to cross every day to get to the swim club, and we, you know, walked to the club by ourselves on a unpaved road, and we, you know, walked on the railroad tracks to a candy store called Bumps, and bought candy from an old man, and so it was even though it was in California and it was in the Bay Area, it felt maybe a little undeveloped.
Yeah,
and
small townish. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And were you, I mean, you left, but I mean, were you happy there? Did you start to get dissatisfied with being in a small town?
I left because of stand-up. Like, I started, I grew up there, went to school, to university very quickly, dropped out, went back home to sort of like lick my wounds and figure it out. And then I left kind of for good, I guess, in 98. But that's just for comedy purposes. And part of me would love to go back one day when I'm really old, because I miss Mount Diablo and I miss those, you know, whatever you grew up with, those landmarks, I miss them a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see them again and walk around the hills and stuff.
Like a salmon.
Yeah.
You turn there
sure,
to die.
Like a salmon.
Yeah. Just
whenever
squirt out a bunch of eggs and just die.
Yeah, for sure. So I love it and I miss it, even though it got a lot richer and wealthier after I left.
Did and your folks, your dad was some kind of engineer that traveled a lot?
Yeah, he was a civil engineer, and he There was a terrible recession in the late 70s, and my dad lost his job at Bechtel, and then he just started going overseas for work. Like, he worked in the Philippines, he worked in Saudi Arabia, he worked in Nicaragua during the Civil War, and like he was in a helicopter that was being shot at because government forces thought they were Sandinistas, which my dad, not a Sandinista, folks, so very Republican. So he was gone from a lot when I was from age, for me, age 12 to say, you know, when I got out of high school. So yeah. I definitely missed him. And, you know, like many young girls without their father figure, turned to the wrong person for a father figure. And then that led to lots of therapy. So, you know,
How long would he be gone at a time?
6 months to maybe a year. And again, this is like the late 70s, early 80s. So, you know, telephone calls were like impossibly expensive. Right. And my dad would just send us these blue airmail letters, but he wrote, it was illegible. I don't know what, you know, I don't know if he said, I love you, or I was, you know, I'm being killed. I have no idea. Yeah. So, So the communication was pretty sparse, you know, back then.
How did your mom deal with that? So, and first of all, do you have any siblings? I don't know.
I do. I have a sister. She's a child psychiatrist.
And is she older or younger?
She's younger. She's younger. In Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
My mom, was pretty depressed. And then, I know she did more than this, but when my dad was gone during, I mean, when early childhood, she was kind of, you know, fun and fine. And then having the whole burden of these two teenage daughters growing up, you know, and taking care of them by herself probably wasn't her, you know, she probably needed help. She was in the backyard pulling rocks out of the dirt. Like, we had so she used to like take the milk cartons and bring them out with her in the backyard. And she would just pull rocks out of the dirt to, I don't know. I don't know if she was going to start a farm, if that was her intention, but she spent a lot of time out there.
What were the milk cartons for? Did she like plant things in the milk carton? And
No. The milk cartons were to put the rocks in. So she, you know, get a spoonful or a cupful of dirt and pull the rocks at it, drop it in the milk carton. And then she would take the milk carton and move the rocks to the front yard where she had organized the rocks, where she wanted them to be like, kind of like in the, like in a gravelly area.
Wow. Wow, that's like a like one of those you know, specifically Greek tortures down in Hades. You know?
You're right.
And the next morning, all the rocks are in the backyard.
My God! But my mom was from Chicago, so I didn't know if that was a Chicago thing. Maybe you'd go, "Oh yeah, I used to do that as a kid."
Oh yeah, yeah, that's called rock transporting. Hey, you're rocking the backyard.
Common in Darien, sure.
Yeah. I did, one of the kid farm jobs around us was called, they called walking beans, which just meant before they planted the beans and they had turned over the soil, you just walked through a field and picked up every rock that had been unearthed.
Oh.
It was a shitty job.
Just yeah, like, it sounds, you know, like an awful
job.
Yeah.
No, there were lots of those. Not as bad as baling hay. Baling hay was bad. Baling hay just, and especially because I'm allergic, it was just impossible.
Oh, that's awful. I would imagine, though, good for your core, if you're not allergic, right?
Baling hay? Yeah, but I had no idea what, I had no form back then.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Price drop? Time to shop. Get to a Nordstrom Rack store today for first dibs on new markdowns. Now score even more, up to 70% off brands everyone loves at Nordstrom Rack. Denim, dresses, sneakers, tops, and more. Plus, get genius deals on jackets, sweaters, and boots for the whole family. Shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and save up to 70% with new markdowns. But hurry, deals this great won't last.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Do you want to talk about when you said that your dad being gone, you sought out the wrong kind of father figure? Do you want to specify that a little more?
Oh, sure. I mean, he's in jail.
Yeah. Good.
No, he was my swim coach, and he ended up being like a serial child molester for
my God.
30 plus years. And he was only caught like in 2008 is when they actually pinned him down. And it almost exactly like the Catholic Church, how they'd move priests around. They would just let coaches get new jobs. And, you know, the parents didn't really know how to have a way to connect with the parents from the previous club. They'd move out of state or just, you know, move far enough away where no one was really talking. Or, you know, every parent thought their daughter was the only one this happened to. And they didn't, you know, they were just, if they even knew.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So prey upon, you know, generations of female swimmers.
Jesus
sadly.
Christ.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
And then some awesome 14-year-old that he molested during a massage. She was famous for giving massages before your race. You know, I mean, when you say it out loud, you're like, this sounds terrible. But at the time, you're like, you know, yeah, okay, I guess so. She told an adult, and it went on from there. And then they started calling around to other, you know, previous swim teams to find out if there had, you know, because there always is more. And there were so many more. It was unbelievable. So he was sentenced to 40 years in prison, which is like a really long. I mean, he'll die there because he was in his 70s when he was sentenced. But usually they don't seem to get that kind of a sentence. So it was satisfying, but, you know.
So did your disillusionment start? Because you said he wasn't really caught until later. Did your disillusionment with him kind of start while you were still there? Like, did you start to smell a rat or, you know?
I think after some stuff happened to me, then I was so, and then it was weird because I'd see him having other jobs and I'd be like, they gotta know, right? Because I had tried to tell people and no one seemed to care, almost to the point where I thought, oh, I guess it's, I didn't realize it was illegal. I just thought it was bad.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah, when they started bringing charges against him, you know, so many of us were like, oh, yeah, not only can I tell you what happened to me, I know two other girls, you know, I had tried to tell some adults and no one really seemed to do anything at the time. This was like the mid-80s when I tried to tell. So.
And did that have a lot of repercussions? I mean, obviously it had some, but it's kind of a variable amount, it seems to be, with victims of that kind of abuse.
Well, I've never been married or had a successful relationship with a man, and I'm a female comic. So I don't think so. I think I bounced back pretty well.
Okay. Yeah,
I work every night possible, so there's no way anyone could be close to me. So I think I got it under control, Andy. Didn't affect my life at all.
Oh, good. Good job. Hey, you really found a great way. You should be on Oprah and tell her about your coping mechanisms. Become a stand-up. Push it all into a box.
If you can turn it into a joke, it was worth it, you know?
Oh, dear. Oh, my. Well, I mean, that's kind of become your specialty.
I know.
I mean, it's sort of, you know, I mean, we'll get into it later, but I mean, you have like albums and books about, you know, people in your life dying and, you know, and the hilarious takes you have on the death of loved ones. Well, now, so did you swam in school? Did you swim in college? What happened in college?
I did. I swam at UCLA for a year, but I dropped out my freshman year. I think the buildup of stuff with my old coach, and then I had some unchecked bulimia that was like out of control when I went to college. It was one of those things where I'm like, as soon as I get away from my parents, or as soon as I get away from the house and go to college, I'm sure this will stop.
Yeah.
You know, and it, of course it got worse to the point of where I was just going to swim practices and then staying in my dorm room and, you know, eating and getting rid of food the entire time. So my grades were going down the toilet. And then again, I was like, all right, I'm just going to drop out and I'm going to get this under control and I will be back in 3 months. And then I never came back. So I might still be enrolled at UCLA. I'm not really sure.
You'd be getting bills. You would be getting bills if you were. Yeah, yeah. So what do? You go back home and and just kind of regroup? Are you thinking?
Yeah, I went home.
I got to make all this into jokes. So far, it's been a bummer.
Went home to regroup. And then I couldn't regroup. Like, I just couldn't. It was almost like, you know, there's like things have spilled out of a bag and you're like, well, let me just put these back in the bag and go on my way. And instead, more things started spilling out. And then I'm just surrounded by garbage and I don't know what to do. So I read this book by this lady named Jeanine Roth and it was called Breaking Free from Compulsive Eating. And it was really important to me because it was I had so many rituals and so it was a way to sort of just undo those, if you could, as much as I could by myself. And so part of it was like letting yourself eat as much as you want, you know, keep it inside you. And if you gain weight, you gain weight. It won't be forever, probably.
Yeah.
And so I had quit swimming and I gained like 60 pounds in 2 months. And it was terrifying. I was like, when is this going to stop? And then it kind of leveled off.
Were you eating excessively or were you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Because it was always like, oh, I'm not going to let myself have that. And then I would have it later, but I would feel awful about it. So then I would say, all right, I'm just going to eat this in front of people. If my mom walks by, I'm just going to keep eating it. I'm not going to hide it. I'm not going to do it late at night. And so slowly just not getting rid of the shame of eating in front of people. And, you know, although I still don't love to eat in front of people. I don't like a witness to the crime of eating, but,
I know what you mean.
But, so that started to help. And then, when the weight gain kind of plateaued, I was like, I felt like I'd, you know, like touched the bottom a little bit. And then, I don't know, I was kind of working like these awful little jobs. I was a telephone solicitor. I was, I worked as a house cleaner and stuff like that, just trying to figure it out, not sure what was happening. And then I started to go see stand-up comedy in San Francisco. I drive out at night to the city and just see tons of stand-up. And I kind of fell in love with it. And then,
was that a pre-existing thing? Had you always kind of liked it or had an interest in it, or it just hit you?
Yeah, no. I mean, honestly, most of the comics I saw were guys, and so I didn't go, I got to do that. And even though I love Steve Martin, I didn't think, oh, I could do that, you know?
Yeah.
And Joan Rivers was like pretty famous when I was growing up, but I didn't connect with what she was doing, you know? I felt like it was a lot of... Like, I don't need to go on stage and tell people I hate myself. Like, I, you know, like,
right.
I do that 24 hours a day anyway. I don't need to.
And I mean, she was kind of old fashioned. It was a very old fashioned kind
how
of.
How she came up and what she was allowed to talk with and about, and in the way that you were allowed to talk about being a woman in the 60s was, you know, totally, you know, I get what she did and everything, but it didn't make me go, oh, me too. I want to do that too. But then I just started seeing some stand-ups in San Francisco, and then I saw some that weren't that good, and I was like, oh, I think I could be better than that person. And that's kind of what got me interested in trying open mics. And it was still a long time because I wanted to be thin first. You know, I still had that in my head. I still have it in my head. You know, I got up on stage heavy, you know, and I didn't make fat jokes about me. Yeah. I made jokes about the names of the stores I was allowed to shop at. And, that, you know, and I was like, yeah, I don't know. It was just like a slow sort of thing, but I really enjoyed it and I loved it. And I think part of what helped me lose some obsession with food and that counting calories and just the keeping track and all that kind of stuff was that I had something really exciting to look forward to and to work on and to practice, you know, and mm-hmm. it filled some hole that was before just a gaping wound. So,
okay.
Yeah.
When you came back home, I mean, was your dad there or was he still kind of on the road? And
my dad stopped doing those kind of road trips, you know, like 6 months in countries that were, and they were never safe countries too, because he was always building infrastructure. So it was always
bridges,
you know,
and shit like that.
Yeah. And so it was, you know, it was always stuff where the government was a little dodgy and you worried for his safety. I guess in my mid-20s, he sort of came back to the States for good and found local work, enough local work to cover things.
But when you came home from college, I mean, what was mm-hmm. the situation like? Did you find a supportive environment?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. My dad drove down in the Chevy Chevette and picked me up and came back. He didn't ask any questions, but that was more, you know, I don't know. He was being supportive, but also he could have asked one or two questions.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was his style, right? So
it was a style. And it's also, I think that is the water that a lot of, that's the level that a lot of dad's water seeks.
Yes.
It's just kind of like, I know you're in trouble. I love you. I'm here. And you need to ride somewhere. Okay. You know.
Yeah.
But I don't know what to say about it because I don't know what to say about it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, it was a lot of, had I unloaded everything, you know, and maybe I did tell him stuff later. I know he knew stuff later, but it was more than he was emotionally trained to cope with for sure.
Yeah. So what do they think when you start saying, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian?
I think at that point they were so worried about me that anything that I felt excited about, they were happy about. Yeah. My dad was, you know, here's the thing. My dad was gone for so much during key years that, I lived at home for 10 more years after that. Cause I just kind of wanted to like have those 7 years I was supposed to have, know, with them. Yeah. So even though I started getting more work as a stand-up, I didn't like move to LA like everybody did, like my class did, you know?
Yeah.
I stayed back and maybe it was a bad career choice, but I do feel like I got those teenage years in my 20s with my dad. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that's pretty important, especially if it worked out that way. I mean, it would have sucked if, you know, you'd stuck around for 7 years and you didn't have much fun with him.
Yeah.
Did you get along a lot better with your dad than with your mom?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think the mother-daughter relationship's really, really tricky.
Yeah.
Really tricky.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom was probably a little emotionally invasive, and I'm still like, she died a year ago and I'm still trying to understand who she was and what our relationship was. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
now that she's not here, I have like room to evaluate a little bit. And, her intentions were really good. Everyone else in her family, the execution wasn't, you know, great.
Yeah.
All the time.
But, and well, it is kind of like, and especially since you're a mother, you do end up kind of feeling like, well, this is my model, you know, like this is my model for that particular, you know, that kind of parent. You know, so it's you do end up sort of, it's way more kind. My ex-wife and I have a boy and a girl, and I definitely think that there's something, there's just less clutter in the emotional relationship between me and my daughter. Mm-hmm. And between her and my son, it all gets the tumult of different ages. Shakes it all up anyway. So
who knows? I do feel like, I had a boy, I have a son. So I think the part of the parent that wants a do-over in their life, they apply that to the same gender child, you know?
Yeah.
And, I guess I didn't have that outlet with my son. You know, I was more like, well, let's see how this turns out. I have no idea what boys are like. I'm excited. And versus girls, I would have been like, I know it can go wrong. And, I would have probably projected a lot of my shit onto a girl.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably, first of all, I think women think about parenting about 6,000% more than men think about parenting when they're parents, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, parents, you know, not like just men like that are in their, you know, late 20s and thinking possibly about having. I mean, guys that have 4 kids don't think about parenting much sometimes.
Right.
But I do think that you do. There's so much like wrapped up in just the self-identification and the fear of fucking it up. And like you put it perfectly, like you feel like you could fuck up a girl. But because it's a boy, there's no, what are you going to do? That might as well be a horse or a fish, I don't know how to raise those things.
I know. I'm like, I'm all ears. What do you want? You tell me. I'm just here.
Want to make guns out of everything? All right. I guess that's your thing.
I read about this.
Yeah, yeah. So what is it? When you get on stage, is it... You know, the first few times, when you really start to, because I mean, there's the time when you're sitting in the audience, you think I can do this, mm-hmm. but then there's a different time when you're on stage and you're like, I think I can do this. And that even has steps because you can think, I think I can do this. And then 2 years later, you're still feeling like, I think I can do this, but it's just a bigger, more, you know, I mean, I didn't do stand up, but I definitely know in making a living at show business, there were times early on, I'm like, I think I can do this. And then it'd be another 5 years and I'd be like, no, I really think I can. And it was a more evolved one and a more sort of like real one. Whereas the first one seemed in retrospect, desperately naive. Like the thought that I could do this from where I was sitting was ridiculous, mm-hmm. you know, knowing how hard it is. And what was it like? And when was it that you think you first felt that on stage?
Well, you know, I remember thinking, not that I would be a famous comedian. I was like, if I could only just be comfortable on stage like these people are, you know?
Yeah.
I was so uncomfortable talking to people and I didn't know how to. And you just see these comics, you know, entertaining a crowd. They go into the audience, they go back to their set and I didn't know exactly even what that was, you know. I just was like, this is magical. How did they do this? And so I thought if I could get to that point and be like that on stage, all of my other problems would be solved, right? I wouldn't, you know, all my stuff would be back in the bag,
right,
you know.
Right. So it's all crowd work. If you just get crowd work down.
And my first time on stage was I brought everyone. It was what they now call a bringer show, where you, as a comic, have to bring the audience. So wasn't named that at the time, and I just brought everyone from my management consulting telemarketing department see the show. And there was Ernest Borgnine. You know Ernest Borgnine, right? So he had a wife, and her name was Tova Feldsha.
Yes,
and she had
I was just about to make the joke. Oh, you mean Tova Feldsha's husband?
I don't even know who she, like, I just, her, because my mom bought some of her makeup once, there was just tons of catalogs all over the house. So
she had a makeup line and a wig line, possibly.
Probably, yeah. So all he did was bring up one of her brochures and make fun of it, right? And that kind of. I got a good response and I was like, oh, this is, I got this. And then the next week I came back with the same thing, but no audience. And I bombed and I was like, thrown for a loop and almost checked myself into a hospital. It was so painful and shocking, you know, like, cause if you kill the previous, you think you figured it out. And then like, if I had gone up and just bombed the first time, maybe I wouldn't have been so shocked, but the disparity between the two audience responses was very disturbing.
Yeah.
And then I took a year off and took stand-up comedy classes. Various places in San Francisco. And that really helped a lot and made me feel more prepared, I guess. Yeah.
So what ended up making you move?
I guess I felt like I'd done enough. I was 34. I mean, at some point you shouldn't be living with your parents, right? I was on the road a lot. It wasn't like home a lot, you know, at the end. And but it was, I was so tired and I wasn't moving up, right? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't getting TV spots or I wasn't getting all the things you're supposed to get in order to move up to the next, like to headline, you know?
Yeah.
I did Montreal, New Faces, and a lady who was my agent for a little bit said you should move to New York, and I was like, okay, well, a New Yorker said I should move to New York, and that was enough for me, and so I did.
And was that validated immediately? Like, did you feel like this is a good thing? And
yeah,
did you like it?
I loved it.
Oh, good.
I mean, from Walnut Creek to Manhattan, it was a huge jump. And I stayed with my friend Ray James. He had he was renting, like a place that must be worth millions now, but it was in Williamsburg in 98.
Yeah.
So it wasn't worth much at all. And so he let me stay with him and I took the subway for the first time and just all this first time stuff. And I'm like, this is magical. I can't believe I'm here. I'm allowed here. And then I went back home to like collect myself. And then around 6 months later, I moved out there. Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's great. And what is were they like finally or did they? We want to use that room.
Nope, they never used the room. My dad always wanted me to move back home. And when I had my kid, he's like, you guys could live here. He was, you guys could stay forever. So, it just felt like, you know, as a grown up at some point, it was time to.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
I mean, do you start headlining at that point, or?
A little bit, but I stopped taking road work almost, this is like late 90s, so I had a website, you know, I was like one of the first comics to have my own website, and I coded it myself. I mean, HTML, not like real coding languages or anything. Right. But back then, if you just knew enough HTML to throw a page together, you could get work. like $25 an hour. I was paid in 99 to work for a couple of media companies. So that was my day job in Manhattan, which I couldn't believe I had a job in Manhattan. Yeah. And then at night I would do spots. And so I just thought, well, let me just stay here for a year or two or whatever and just, you know, get my claws in this scene and become part of this scene. So that was my goal. And then I kept up some road work so I wouldn't lose my long set chops, I guess. But mostly I tried to turn myself from a road comic to a New York City comic, you know, which is so different. And it took a while and it was painful.
And can you make a living as a New York City comic, you know, that at the same level that you would be as a road comic? I mean,
if you're working weekends, I think you can make enough money if you're, you know, you're in rent stabilized housing, you know, like, you have to work every weekend and you have to be one of those comics that gets like 6 to 8 spots on Friday and Saturday. And then you just boom, 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 boom. And it's exhausting.
But and you just pick up a little cash from each one, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know many that only do that, though. I mean, everyone sort of tries to balance it out with road work. And, you know, if you lose a club or two, if the booker changes or someone gets annoyed with you, then all of a sudden you have no income, you know? Yeah. Because every week you find out that week if you're going to be making money. You know, it's stand-up comedy because usually the avails are done a week in advance. So
it sounds so – I mean, like I say, I'm not a stand-up, but – and I guess – you know, like my parents would ask me when I was, you know, working basically freelance, you know, when I wasn't working on the Conan show and I'd be working on a show and they'd say, what happens when this ends? And I'd be like, I don't know, you know, and that would blow their minds because they just couldn't conceive of living like that. But to me, like even like just to make a regular thing out of week to week of like, am I going to go to Baltimore and do whatever, 3 sets a day for 4 days. Like I just feel like that's so much
instability,
stress and instability and stuff. And I guess, and there's just something like, I get, why do you think it, what do you think it is about it that's such a draw to people? Because, you know, the standups that we know are just a tiny sliver of all these like, real working class comics that are doing this over and over and over.
To me, it's still exciting that you can get on a plane, fly to a place, do a bunch of shows, and leave with money. Even just this last weekend, I'm like, I did it again. Like, I can't believe I'm still allowed. And those things are usually booked a couple months in advance, you know? Uh-huh. But the New York thing is, you know, it's even more exciting when it's all happening because, you know, you got to give yourself about an hour between each set, you know? But sometimes you're like, oh, if these clubs are close together, I can do 1 set at 10 and 1 set at 10:40. But everything has to run on time. So you get to the club at 9:50 and they're running 5 minutes over and you're like, my heart out is 10:20 and I can't get out any later than that. So they either get the other person off or you go up and you do less time and then you run to your next club set. And then you have them around the clock as many as you can because they're, you know, if it's Friday or Saturday, they're between 80 to 100, I don't know what the seller pays, but say at least 125 a set. So if you can start at, you know, with an early show, you know, say 6 o'clock and go till 2 a.m., you might be able to get, you know, 6 or 8 sets in, you know, depending on how far apart they are, you know, like there was always a good run if you could do the comic strip, which was on 82nd and 2nd, and Stand Up New York, which is on 79th and Broadway, because you could just go right through the park and they were 10 minutes apart. So you could like an 8 o'clock at the strip and get off stage by 8:15, 8:20, grab your cash, run into a cab and be at Stand Up for your 8:40. And then you could go back to the strip for their next show and back to Stand Up for the next show. Cause they would each have usually at that time, you know, 3 shows a night, right? Yeah. So you just bing, 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 bing. And all you would spend is your cab fare and the rest of it is cash you keep. And that's always exhilarating. I mean, it's so stressful. And when I used to always do that as much as I could. And then when I would, you know, came out to LA for Conan and I would go back to New York just to, you know, do that. I realized, wow, this is really stressing me out. And before I didn't even notice, I'm like, that's how you live. This is it.
Right, right.
I stopped being as aggressive of, I gotta have one spot an hour.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, it is very tiresome. And you aren't necessarily getting good work done on your act. You're just trying to not, you know, especially if you're at a club on the 8 o'clock show, then you go do a set in another club, then you come back for the 10 o'clock. It feels like you're, you know, did I already tell this joke to this audience? Because I was just on this stage, you know, an hour and 15 minutes ago and you can't remember. So I would go, this is my set list for the night. And I'm telling these jokes in this order 8 times tonight.
Wow.
And I can't deviate because otherwise I will probably end up repeating something or go insane.
I was going to ask, and you alluded to it a little bit there. Does it hurt? Does all that stress and all that rush, does it hurt the work?
I don't know. I don't think so. I feel like the audience is as stressed, but in different reasons. Like we're all just sort of, you know, this high anxiety. I think on the weekends, it's like your money gigs. So artistically, maybe you're not going to come up with new text. Maybe you might, but maybe you probably, you know, you're just banging stuff out and trying to get off on time, and get to the next thing on time. And the weeknights are a little more, you know, you got one spot, you got two, and they're 2 hours apart and they're in different boroughs. And, you know, the crowd is weird because only weird people come out to the Tuesday night show, which is good. It's just fun. You need some weird people. You don't want every crowd to be date night from New Jersey, which is Friday and Saturday.
Yeah. That's New Jerseyist.
I told you before I consented to do this podcast, I would come after them.
I wonder, like, are you thriving on that anxiety and that stress? Like, is that part of what you like about it? And if so, do you know why? Do you ask yourself why, or, you know?
I think at the time it made me feel like a real comedian, you know? And I guess it still does, because you kind of always feel like you can get kicked out of stand-up comedy, you know, pretty quickly, you know? All it takes is everyone not returning your phone call.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reasons. And so I personally, I'm not at like this level where I feel where I'm completely safe in my career. So I'm always like, I did it again. I was a comic for another week. Ha! You know, it feels I played a trick on the expectations I grew up with and maybe, you know, the track that I was on, which was, you know, it was just the track that all the girls I grew up with were on. And I went a little bit different and I'm still able to pull it off.
Why? And this is always something, and I may have even asked you at one point, because whenever we did road shows, whenever we went to New York or wherever, Dallas, mm-hmm. or
Chicago,
or Comic-Con, mm-hmm. you, the first night, you know, we'd have like, there'd be a dinner planned and then it'd be, you would be like through with your appetizer and be like, gotta go, doing two sets. And I always would sit there and think, what are you getting out of that? Like,
right.
And I don't know. And that's, I think it's also too, it's like, I like what I do for a living. And at times I love what I do for a living, but it's still work. And I was raised that work is supposed to be something that you avoid, you know, like you don't like eagerly ask for more, you know?
Well, I guess stand-up feels different from Conan, you know,
in terms
of like a thing I do. And also, there were many times where I'm like, why am I leaving this dinner?
Yeah.
Why am I darting away? Like it is a habit you get into and the constant feel like if I have a night off, I'm a loser. If I have New Year's Eve off, I'm a loser. I'm not in the business anymore. And that's just like an old thing of when you start doing your open mics. If you have every night filled, you know,
then you feel good.
Yeah, you feel good. And and I mean, I'm obviously since COVID and the, you know, pandemic, I do feel a little differently about like, I'm going to dash off and, you know, run out again. I kind of probably won't be doing that as much. I do, you know, cherish. And I've spent the whole year home with my son and it's been awesome, you know, so I don't want to run out all the time.
Yeah. You know? It's nice that you got to have that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's great.
Thank you, pandemic.
It giveth and it taketh away.
Now, you, how do you start writing for, you didn't write for Conan first. You wrote for a couple other shows first, right?
Tough Crowd was my first writing job.
With Colin Quinn, yeah.
Yeah.
And was that, did he hire you from the clubs or did you submit a packet to producers or?
A packet. I met him, we did a show for Comedy Central at Gitmo. Mm-hmm. you can't find it, by the way. It's been taken off the air and burned, but like Lenny Clark was on it. It was a fun show.
Yeah.
We just didn't know we were entertaining torturers at the time. But
you were entertaining the troops, not the actual prisoners.
correct.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I get it now. It's a different mind picture.
Right. So I met him there and I heard about the show and then, he hired a ton of comics to write for him. And, I hadn't thought of myself as a writer, even though I wrote a lot of like little stuff for my website. But, but then some of the comics, I was like, I don't think that person's a writer. You know, that's more of a performer. And then I thought, oh, well, if that's the bar, maybe I could write something that'd be enough to get hired. And so that sort of allowed me to dream that I could do that as well. And I definitely wanted to be part of that crew because that was like, to me, that was like the top crew in New York City. It was like the Cellar crew.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to be a part of that world desperately.
In with the in crowd.
Yeah.
And I met, were you like, wow, I can make jokes and get a decent living here without having to run all over town?
I worked more spots than ever when I was a Tough Crowd.
Oh,
like
wow.
I would, cause I got passed at the Cellar and she would have me MC and that goes till 2 a.m. and then you got to be a Tough Crowd at like, 9:30 a.m. But I was like, this is great. You know, work me till I'm dead. If I can do spots every single night and then Monday through Friday, be a Tough Crowd. I was like, this is the dream. I was like, I'm living the dream. I'm in Manhattan. It's all happening, you know?
Yeah.
So I was exhausted. I was exhausted at that time, but I loved it.
And how does Conan come about? Just an agent submitting?
No, I had submitted for Late Night and I had submitted for The Tonight Show.
Uh-huh.
And then I was out here. I had just gotten recently fired from the Bonnie Hunt Show. And then I did Last Comic Standing. There was like this little 3 months of where I was a contestant on Last Comic Standing. And then you guys were hiring. And Kylie told me. Kylie was always like the one going, hey, we're hiring. And so he let me know. And I did a third packet. And I guess that was enough.
Oh, wow. That's great. And what was it like? Did that move you to L.A.? Had you moved
No,
to
I was already out here for the Bonnie Hunt Show.
Oh, okay. And what was it like coming into the Conan crew?
Oh, I mean, my God.
Like in comparison
terrifying.
To all the different places that you've worked.
Yeah. I mean, because to me, not to say like Tough Crowd wasn't like it wasn't like a writer's medium. It was a performer's medium, right? It was all, it was Colin, although he's a great writer and he would write his own monologues and stuff. But it was all about the four comics who were on
sparring.
The show with Colin. Right.
Yeah,
yes,
it's like
exactly.
A sparring thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but this is a writer's show.
Yeah.
You know, and it was incredibly intimidating. Up and almost just until recently had imposter syndrome. And then I got it again because when we dropped the monologue, I was like, what do I do?
Yeah.
That's what I'm, kind of good at. And the last year was like a revisiting some old anxieties. But it was terrifying, I think I got a joke on the first show, his first show back, and I was so relieved, that helped. But
yeah,
it was like being accepted in a school that you probably think you don't have the grades for. It's like, why?
Oh, that's
what happened?
That is funny. That is funny to think that, like, somehow that our show was like, you know, I don't know, like the MIT. cordon bleu, you know.
This show was MIT and I was community college material for sure. Like, whoa, man.
Yeah.
They're going to find out.
How long did it take you to settle in? I mean, well, first of all, you were on The Tonight Show, so you were there for like, were you?
No, just TBS.
Just a TBS.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to settle in? Like, how long did you start to feel like, you know, okay, I'm here as long as I want to be. And
well, I never felt like that. You know,
yeah, you should have. It's not a complacent thing, but I do think that it's like, I personally feel it's easier to be funny when you're not scared. And
yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I felt like, I felt liked, and oddly enough, I didn't feel like I was an actual funny. I felt as opposed to being a person who could maybe write some jokes for myself, I didn't feel like I was truly a funny person till my dad died, and I started working with all that, and then I was like, oh, okay. So if I was able to do that, I probably have it. But it took a while. I had to lose a lot before I actually had any confidence in myself. So
let's talk about that. Like, in, you know, cause you did sort of, you know, you turned the death of your father into comedy, and then you got to do it again with your mom and during COVID on a fucking iPad. It was,
it was crazy.
It was so crazy. And, but it was also too, you know, like knowing you and watching this remotely happening and just, you know, with my heart breaking for you and feeling terrible. And then you're being fucking hilarious through the whole thing, which is just,
thanks.
It's an enjoyable kind of crazy. It's a, it's like a what do you call it? A useful bacteria. You know?
A probiotic.
Yeah. It's like this is actually, it's, you know, this thing is really fucked up, but look at it's getting all, you know, it's making cheese, you know? But yeah, tell me about that. Like, your dad got sick and, you know, did you have to go back home for him?
Yeah, I remember my dad, like, my dad had cancer, and this is my first big death, right? So I wasn't prepared for it, and I was still like, he's not going to die. Not my dad, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, the previous weekend before he went, his hospice started, he'd come down to L.A., and we drove to Joshua Tree.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he's super weak and stuff, but, you know, it's weird. Like, you just think, your brain can't stop thinking they'll get better.
Yeah.
Right. despite all the evidence. And then the next week, you know, my mom said that, you know, the doctor wants dad to come home for hospice. And I told Sweeney, I'm like, is it okay if I go home this weekend? And he's like, you should leave now. It's helpful to have a boss that knows how quickly death can come.
Yes.
You know, you don't want some 24-year-old boss going, well, okay, can't you do it next week? Right.
Tell him to hold on.
I was home for, I guess it was 10 days of hospice, I think, 9 or 10 days. And, you know, if you've been through that, it's just a mind-blowing experience. My dad was conscious the entire time except for the last night. And the next day, of course, he died. So we were just able to give him the good death, right? We had family coming over. People were calling. People were visiting. He got to hear everything a person should get to hear about how they affected people, you know, a good person, at the end of his life, you know. And then at the very last 3 days, it was just like me, my sister, and my mom taking care of him, you know, and telling him everything, right, and ushering him off. And then so when I was home, I wasn't going to do stand up. You know, I had that desire. I'm like, oh, there's so many open mic. I'm back in the Bay Area. So many clubs, you know, and I'm like, oh, I don't want to. Yeah. What if my, you know, I guess I was getting that my dad was dying, you know, and maybe I don't want to be gone tonight. Maybe. So I just started, you know, jokes I would have tried that night at an open mic. I just decided to tweet instead. And then that sort of took off on its own, or Patton Oswalt retweeted it. And then I took off. And then I was home for the duration. I wasn't going to leave. And, So I just kept, you know, writing jokes through it because it worked. And also,
but when you say it worked, what do you mean it worked?
Like people responded to it. They liked it. And, you know, they weren't bombing. And, you know, I still needed that something there.
But when you say it, do you think it also worked and then it just gave you something, you know?
Yeah.
Somewhere to channel this.
Give myself a way to kind of like track what was happening, you know?
And cope with it in the way that you know how to, that you process things.
Sure. You know? I mean, you know, when you're writing the monologue, you're writing at least 30 jokes a day. So it's just sort of, you know, it's just sort of a
thing muscle
you get used to doing all the time. And and also, you know, when people started, you know, replying or responding, it was all like, you know, stuff we could tell my dad, like, you know, he was like an old Catholic prayer, believes in prayer. So, you know, we'd be like, oh, these people are praying for you. These people are from Australia. And we just kind of showed him all that stuff. And I think, I think that made him feel, you know, it just added to the perhaps, you know, feeling that he was, you know, being cared for on this journey.
Yeah, yeah. Probably got him into heaven, too.
I hope
so. If you hadn't gotten those, if people on Twitter to pray. But I bet up in heaven, they're like, hey, shit, we got to let this guy in here. Let this put Martin in here.
You got 15,000 Facebook likes. He can come in. He can come in.
Now, this turned into a special and a book, right?
Yeah, I did it. I started doing these jokes about my dad dying in the middle of my act, like a club act, like, you know, in Tucson. I was at Laughs in Tucson and I doing my regular, you know, I talk a lot about parenting and, you know, just all the stuff, the daily stuff we all go through. And then I'm like, and then my dad died and da, 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 da. And, you know, it's such a shift, for people that just, you know, came out to comedy with their Groupon, or whatever. And I realized, well, you know, I'd love
to like bachelor party.
Yes. Vibrators on a table.
Bachelorette parties.
So, I thought, well, you know, I have, you know, a growing chunk of material that people are either they really like it or this is not what they came for.
Yeah.
And so I thought, let me just do a separate show, you know, and I decided to do a special to kind of pressure myself. And then I had made me write a lot more stuff. And I took it out to a couple of little black box theaters and little places that would let me. And I called it 45 jokes about my dead dad. So everyone would know there would be no, hey, I came here for dick jokes. Although I had some dick jokes in there.
Sure, of course. Your dad had a dick, you know, you might as well throw one in there.
Exactly. I helped change his diaper. So, yeah. I filmed it and CISO ended up buying it later on. And it's a CD as well. And then, but before I filmed it, I spent a ton of money on it and I couldn't get anyone interested in it before CISO. And so I was like, God dang it. So, I pitched a book. I'd already written a parenting book called Shitty Mom. Mm-hmm. And so I just called this is a super casual pitch, but it was like, how about the Shitty Mom of Grief? And it's, you know, just tiny chapters, a lot of jokes and stuff like that. And so, you know, they said, yeah, so I wrote that. And in the interim, CISO bought the special. So they kind of, there's different material in them.
And then, and like, was there any worry that like you were going to now this was going to be your thing? Like, you know, like, like turning something terrible into comedy, you know, like you were going to become like, I don't, you know, the death comic, and then you're going to become the war comic, and then the, you know, the genocide comic, you know?
I don't know. I moved on from it pretty quickly when I was done with it.
And I guess it's just so personal, too. It's like,
yeah, and then, you know, I'm not the only comic that's had dead family, you know. And I know a lot of people that talk about the dead people in their act. So it's definitely, maybe if it was taboo 10 years ago or people didn't know how to do it or the audiences weren't ready for it.
Yeah.
I think now comedy audiences are sort of into all of it. And especially now after COVID, I think they're even more into it because all we've been talking about his death for a year.
And then when your mom passed, I mean, she passed to COVID and you were very frustrated because it was, awful circumstance. Didn't she like go into a rehab facility after a surgery?
She lived with me and her hip popped out of her socket. So and she had to go to the hospital to get that not only put in, but there's other stuff going on. She wasn't in great health.
Yeah.
So she stayed there for a week. And then they said to your mom needs to go to skilled nursing facility, which is sort of, they are often combined with nursing homes, just to rehab, to learn to walk again, you know, cause she had been laying down for a week straight. And she had like, I don't know, two tissues of muscle in her entire body and they were unable to get her to do things. So, so she was supposed to just be there for about a week and, COVID swept through this place. Mm. It was an Eagle Rock. It was called the York, but I don't know, whatever. And she got it. And they told me on Thursday, the June 11th, that she tested positive and that they're taking her to Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. And I got in the car and I tried to intercept at Huntington, you know, the ambulance, which I obviously didn't.
What were you going to do? Were you going to try and just bring her home or something?
I don't know. I thought maybe I could talk to her. I didn't know she was unconscious.
Oh.
You know, like that, the nursing facility she was in, she had been in them before. She's always getting surgeries and rehabbing and they always suck, right? You're put in a room with someone who's insane. And so my mom, I'm used to her complaining about, you know, the nursing facility, right?
Yeah.
So she spent the last week of her life doing that again. And, you know, this facility, like all of them, kind of sucked. And that's a separate thing. I don't know why they all suck. Like, why can't there be a good, I just don't know. But, my huge anger is that the last week of her life sucked, you know, like she was in this awful place and they weren't responding to her. You know, she would tell me that, you know, they need to get this thing and this thing. And I would try and call, my sister would call, we yell at them and stuff like that, but we can't go visit. You know, the other times she'd been like in a nursing facility, go in, say hi, you know, put in some FaceTime, just go, this is my mom, I'll stop by again tomorrow. You know, almost like just letting them know she has someone that's watching.
Yeah.
And obviously we weren't allowed, no one was allowed in. So we didn't know what was going on in there. It sounded like a mess. And I'm like, oh, just get her home. She'll be home soon. And of course she wasn't. So it was pretty bad. I wish I had been able to bust in there and, you know, just go get her an extension cord.
Yeah.
Like she needed that for her phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I had to call in the landline and they would never pick up and just stuff where you're like, ugh.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It was kind of important that, you know, like it was a well-watched and lots of people saw this reality of what was happening. And I think that it was sort of, I know for me, it was kind of sobering about like, oh yeah, shit, Jesus. And how fast it happened and mm-hmm. how frustrating it was and on one hand, you're like, nobody knows, you know, the facility, you know, I made mistakes, but there's also kind of like, well, who knows what's right and what's wrong and who's, you know, who's mm-hmm. figured out what the actual protocols of these things. And, you know, it's like when Conan went to, I mean, this is certainly from something important to something silly, but when I went, you know, like when they had me, I finally got to go to the theater, Largo, when he'd been doing shows there about a month and they just wouldn't let me in because like they couldn't have another person in because who knew? And then it's like, oh, okay. You know, well, I guess we can. And then we did. And you know, we were pretty careful.
Well, it's like with the nursing homes, you know, I now like Gavin Newsom, you know, I blame Trump, but Gavin Newsom did open up California over Memorial Day. And that's kind of the incubation period where somebody got it and worked with my mom and gave it to my mom. Now, the people that work in nursing facilities, you know, they're not paid well. They work multiple places, you know, so they're doing hodgepodge. So they're being exposed to more people than if they, you know, were able to work in one facility only. And mm-hmm. so it's just not it's really poorly structured for an airborne virus that targets it, you know, that really is deadly for the elderly. It's just handing it to them, basically.
Well, hopefully it won't. Well, I mean, we know what we're doing now, hopefully. I mean, so when the next one comes, which I don't think will be 100 years, at least, you know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. I shouldn't go down that road because I'm not feeling particularly optimistic these days. But
I wish, had I known, I would have said after the hospitalization, bring my mom home and we'll have a nurse come in and take care of her. Yeah. But I thought having a nurse come in was more dangerous because I thought, well, they know what they're doing now. This is June. Like, I get how no one knew in March, but they know what to do now. June.
I see.
And they didn't do. They didn't do the. What they're supposed to do, which is be extra careful.
Right. Well, I'm sorry your parents are dead.
Thanks, Andy. I appreciate that.
Sure, no problem. now I do want to, you know, I've kept you here for over an hour now. I want to get to the, you know, the next step of these questions, and that's where are you going? Like, what are you, do you have any plans? I mean, do you, and, you know, and the work stuff is one thing, but, you know, like with your boy,
overall, I'm working on a novel very slowly. Mm-hmm. And
do you like that? Do you like doing it?
I like it when I'm doing it. The hours where I think, why aren't you working on this thing, are hell. But it's sort of like a fictional account of the last year of living, you know, with my mom and my son and I in a very small house. And we can't leave the house. And mm-hmm. my son's father's living in the garage. So that was my conditions for a while.
Oh, wow.
So it's a fictionalized version of that, you know. It's taken a while because I have to fictionalize it. I don't want it to be exactly. And then I also don't want to, sometimes I get lost in, you know, grief or whatever, and I have to like turn that off and just write it. But and then, you know, my son has 4 years of 4 years of high school coming up, and mm-hmm. I want to see a lot of it, you know. I don't know what's going to happen after that. I don't know if he's going to go away to college or stick around here or, you know.
Until he's 34.
Yeah. I would be like my dad. That's fine. I'll keep your room. You know, you can do whatever you want. I don't care. But I want to see as much as I can.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I am trying to make my house prettier because I feel like I will be stuck in it, you know, a little bit. Otherwise I don't know. It's all sort of up in the open right now.
Would you, if somebody came along with another monologue writing job right now, would you go ahead and say yes? You
know? I like writing jokes.
Yeah.
You know, to me, I know like, Jose Arroyo's like such a talented writer.
Yeah.
On our show.
Yeah. Like and one of our, like, you know, if there was a bar graph about just contribution, I think his would be one of the biggest bars.
Yes. And he can do both sketch and mono equally well. I mean, he's so good. And he, you know, is going now for story, and he's going to be great at it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I loved my routine of writing monologue jokes for Conan and then writing jokes for myself at night. And I really liked it, and maybe I'm not as gifted, you know, maybe I can shit out this novel separately, but I really liked that one made the other better.
Yeah.
And they both made the other better.
Yeah.
And I really felt lucky. I knew I was lucky when I was doing it, that I had my day job was writing jokes and my night job was telling jokes. And I knew I was really lucky when I had that. And if I had that again, that would be awesome.
You seem to thrive under structures.
I do, I guess.
I do too. Left to my own devices, I don't know what the fuck to do with myself. So I have to even like invent some structure sometimes.
I know, like 24 hours when you don't have, when it's like open, I get nothing done. But when I mean, it, when a, you know, when you give a busy person something new, it gets done.
Yes.
That, yeah.
Absolutely. Like yeah, too. No, I know. If I have like a 3-hour window and there's things that need to be done, I will get them done in that 3-hour window. Whereas if I have a whole day, I'll be like, Price is Right is on. Well, the last of these of the questions of this podcast are, what have you learned? And I mean, do you have, I mean, you know, there's quite a lot of life in there and quite a lot of death too. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, like, you know, do you get like advice questions, or do you feel like there's some way you've summed it up?
Gosh, I don't know. I feel like I'm still, I still haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all going so quickly, you know, and, I guess I should know more right now, you know, but part of me is like, I still feel 19 and I still just want my next joke to work. And this one joke that isn't working and I know is good. And what's wrong with that? I mean, I still love solving that little puzzle, that problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe I've learned that, I'm not gonna change in the way I thought it would change magically somehow.
Yeah.
Like maybe the person I was when I was 19 is probably about 90% of the person I am now, you know, and maybe I should stop waiting for this idea of a complete and total transformation.
I am right there. That is like so true. And I fucking hate it. And I mean, cause I see it in myself where I, you know, I have the list of improvements, you know, mm-hmm. that I, and the list of things I should be doing. And I mean, I chip away at them a little bit here and there. And as time goes on, it gets a little better, you know, I get kind of more of a handle on it, you know, and then huge upheavals in my life in the last few years have kind of reconfigured everything anyway. But I still do feel like, yeah, like this picture you have of you when you get it all together, like, honey, I think that's a fake. I don't think that's, I don't think that's going to happen. So you better think of like what is now plus like, I don't know, maybe 10% improvement.
Yeah,
and,
maybe.
And that's what I'm going to be going into the ground with. And yes. I hate it.
Yeah.
You know, because I've been mm-hmm. around for so fucking long with this goddamn to-do list.
Yeah.
And I just la-di-da, you know, my way through it. But I don't know. I guess it's the work in that is the hating it, you know, is the not hating it, learning to not hate it, learning it to be like, well, sorry, babe, that's how it goes. That's life. And you're not special in terms of this particular aspect of it. So. Anyway, people, you're not going to change that much. Get used to what you see in front of you in the mirror.
Yes, except this version of yourself. It's probably the best one.
Yeah. And I mean, and also too, the point is too, it's still pretty good. It's, I mean, unless you're a fucking serial killer or a monster or something, mm-hmm. you know, what you see in the mirror is probably pretty good. You know, there's no reason to be so mean. I find like, I'm so mean to so much more mean to myself than I am to anybody else. And I just, mm-hmm. I really lately have been trying to like make the simple step of talking to myself the way that I would talk to somebody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, like in terms of like Josh Gondelman, you know, I love
him. Oh, he's so funny.
It was just a tweet one day that he said, if there's something that some advice that you need to hear, or if you're, you know, like there's some improvement you want to make, tell yourself what you should do the way that you would tell a friend that advice who is in that same situation. And it's such good advice. And it's such like, I think like a powerful thing, because we're always going to tell our friends, you know, well, just give it some time and don't worry about it so much. And whereas like, to me, I would be like, way to go, fucker, you know, way to go, fatso, you did it again, you know, mm-hmm. And I would never say that to anybody else. I wouldn't even dream of saying that to anybody else.
Yeah. You know? And you got to figure at your funeral, most people will have good things to say.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's not bad.
That's not bad. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, And especially if you're like really good and old. All right, Lori. Well, it was good to see you.
And, yeah, it's great
and
to talk see you.
To you. And I'm sure there's going to be some kind of, Conan show soiree,
maybe I hope so. Yeah. Or we'll just bump into each other at Ralph's or Whole Foods or something.
That's right.
Smart
That's
and right. final.
Yeah, exactly. Or, we'll be, I don't know, maybe I'll start doing stand-up just to make people like you furious.
God damn it. Why are sketch people doing it? Why?
You'll be opening for me and I'll be like, ha-ha! I don't even know what I'm doing. All right. Well,
all right.
You have a good summer. And I will talk to you soon. And thank all of you out there for listening to another episode of The Three Questions. We'll be back next week. I've got a big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blair, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts. Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.